it's been the first anniversary since the horrific war began in West Asia with terrorists attacking Israel. But now that war has spread. And certainly one of the key areas which has been badly impacted is Lebanon, with continuous Israeli attacks on the city of Beirut, one of the largest cities and one of the most ancient cities on earth. My colleague Ghazali has been reporting from there and joins us now. For starters, Ghazali, what is the immediate ground situation where you're reporting?
See, I'm in the heart of the city of Beirut, in the city center right now, and the attacks in Beirut is happening on the southern and northern areas. The southern Beirut, or the southern part of Lebanon, shares border with the occupied territory of Palestine, and there a ground combat is going on between the Israeli forces and the Hezbollah fighters. But right here in Beirut, the areas which are under attack is close to the airport area where the attacks are happening. There is another area called Dahiyeh, which I've been reporting, and I have covered from there that how a densely populated area with around 7 lakh people. They have all left the area. Most of the areas have got vacant. People have, the residents of that particular area have left it because it has faced intense bombardment from the occupied Palestinian territory forces. Right now, there is the bigger concern for the government over here is about the displacement of people. People who had moved into Lebanon a decade ago due to the unrest in Syria have now been left yet again to be the refugees, and they're now moving towards Syria again. But the forces from occupied Palestinian territory have also damaged the road which connects Syria and Lebanese border. So the ground, and even now you can hear, I don't know if you can hear or not, but I can still hear the sounds of the drone in the sky. We are sitting in an open area right now. And the explosions can be heard very close to this place because we are sitting very close to the airport. And any area near the airport is still coming under the aerial bombardment. Then there are certain areas away from the city in the suburban areas of Beirut which are coming under intense attack. Many people have been displaced. Millions of people are moving from one location to another. The city areas of Beirut are and the hotels and the colleges, the schools, hospitals, they have all been it's become a makeshift shelter home for these people with local NGOs and international NGOs taking care of them. But since morning, it appeared that today is October 7th, marking 1 year of Israel-Hamas war. But Hezbollah chose to fire rockets into Israel in the Haifa area, which sort of injured around 11 citizens there. As of now, the situation is very tense here because people don't know that who will go for a ceasefire, because despite repeated attempts from the global leaders, there has been no ceasefire, and more new fronts of wars are emerging every day. It started with Gaza, and now it's Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Iran as well. Right now, the situation is tense. There is an eerie silence in the city, but the areas closer to the airport, the area closer to the border of Israel is facing intense bombardment. And then alerts are also issued here as well whenever there is a loud explosion in the nearby areas.
Ghazali, do we have any idea of casualties?
Casualties till now, today there has been casualties in double digits. Exact figure has not yet been shared. The exact figure comes at the end of the day by the Ministry of Health. But till now, since this war has started between Lebanon and Israel, there have been more than 1,500 people who have been killed and many more injured.
What is the condition of hospitals?
The condition of hospitals is still fine in the Beirut city, but the problem is with the displacement of people who are moving on foot, because anywhere they're moving, there are a lot of bombardment in the suburban areas. So a lot of people have shifted into the city areas, into the hotels. Hospitals are doing fine with the collaboration with the NGOs and all, and that is why the hospital situation is still working fine.
What about electricity and basic civic supplies?
The basic civic supplies are also doing fine in the urban areas, but in the suburban areas, it is still a big challenge because there have been attacks on the power facilities as well. And also during the evening hours after sunset, in most of the areas, people turn off the light, fearing that perhaps if they turn on the lights, that area will come under aerial bombardment. So this is the situation right now in the suburban areas and areas close to the Beirut city center.
Can you describe for us what it was like reporting at night when many of these attacks took place?
See, Vishnu, basically the areas, there are many areas which are marked as the stronghold of Hezbollah. You can't enter there without their permission. There is the area called Gahiye, which is the place where the assassination of the leader happened. On the very first day after the assassination, only one photographer was allowed to get into that particular area. And after that, the entry is barred. There are a stronghold of that group, which is spread over across the city and around the outskirts. And that is where the intense bombardment or attack is happening. In areas where there are residential buildings in that particular area, that is very tough. And then you can only move around with the permission of the Hezbollah group or from their media team. Despite having passes, you can't move around in the city like this reporting about it. And you're under constant watch that you are not moving into those areas which are sensitive, like the southern Lebanon, where the ground combat is happening with the Israeli forces. Nobody is allowed in that particular area, and people are displaced from there. The people who are moving out of that place are also facing aerial bombardment. So it's a very tense situation. Until and unless you have an approval, you know the exact location where you want to go, moving around in this particular, on the outskirts of the city is very dangerous.
All right, Ghazali, thank you for joining us, and please be careful in that very, very tense situation. I'm now joined by Edward Joseph, Senior Fellow and Lecturer at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, Adam Scott Bellos, the CEO of the Israel Innovation Fund, Zaki Zaidi, a former researcher at the Institute of Defense Studies and Analysis in India and a Middle East expert, and Ambassador Ashok Sajjanar. Thank you all very much for being with us. Adam Scott Bellos, let me come to you first. What in your mind is the end game for Israel as far as Lebanon is concerned? I know ostensibly it is to get rid of Hezbollah once and for all, but that's not going to be something that can happen soon. Are we looking at, you know, operations which can go on indefinitely at this stage?
I don't think that we're looking at operations that can go on indefinitely, just like I don't think Israel is looking at operations that would go on indefinitely in Gaza as well. The goal is clearly to eradicate Islamism from the region, which has plunged the region into darkness for many, many, many years, culminating in what we saw on October 7th. And I think that's extremely important to recognize, that the Israeli goal vis-a-vis the attack starting on October 7th has been to finally and utterly eradicate this eschatological apocalyptic ideology of what the world should be, made in the image of some type of radical Islamic, dreamland. I think it's very important to realize that the Israelis have very long-term goals for the stability and the prosperity of the region. And as many people have seen, prior to October 7th, the Abraham Accords had begun to bring the Middle East into a new era of brotherhood and business cooperation and prosperity. And we're on the brink of really solving the wider Arab-Israeli conflict, which should have culminated in a Saudi Arabian peace agreement. So I think it's just very naive to think about the lack of idea of what the Israelis would like to accomplish. It's a very clear goal, and it has been, and it has been stated over and over again since the beginning of the Israeli-Iran war, which this is. And to call this the Israel-Hamas war, the Israel-Hezbollah war, is just an incorrect observation of the geopolitical and military realities on the ground right now. This is the Israeli-Iran war. It's the one-year anniversary of the start of the Israeli-Iran war. And to think that there is any other goal other than allowing the rest of the Middle East to live in the same type of prosperity that Israelis have lived in over the last, let's say, 40 years or 50 years since 1967, it would just be very obtuse to think that that isn't the goal of the Israeli people and the Israeli government.
All right. Adam,
I just need to make that very clear.
Adam, hold that thought. Let me go across to Nick Kolyohin. He's a senior journalist reporting the situation on the ground. Nick, thanks very much for being with us. What's the situation in northern Israel?
So now Israel strives to destroy Hezbollah as it did to Hamas, because Israel understands that it can't live with its citizens of the north of the country evacuated from their homes for a year now, and their homes constantly bombarded. They are destroyed by Hezbollah terrorists, and no country could live in this kind of reality. So now Israel is intensifying their fight against Hezbollah, and they have many targets that the Israeli intel over the years gathered information about them. And now there are strives to destroy especially the long missiles of Hezbollah, the precise missiles, because with those ones they can target Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and all Israel. And that's why now Israel understands after the 7th of October, it couldn't live with a neighbor that has so many firepower and do nothing. That's why now Israel going all in its strive to destroy all the proxies of Iran. And it's not just Hezbollah in Lebanon. It's also the Houthis in Yemen and also the militias in Iraq and in Syria. That's all of them are working with Iran.
Nick, could you tell us what's happening behind you? Today is a particularly poignant day in Israel where the families of those who've lost so much, I mean, the thoughts of people around the world are with them. Could you tell us a little bit about what's happening and, you know, and how the memory of what happened a year back is perhaps first and foremost in the minds of people in your country?
Yes, in Israel, this is a big tragedy. After the Holocaust, this is the second biggest tragedy in the history of the Jewish people. 1,200 people were murdered, slaughtered by the terrorists of Hamas. Many of them children, women, elderly, innocent people that were in their homes in pajamas. Some of them were at music festival. They did nothing wrong. But the Hamas terrorists came with one mission: to kill, to kidnap, to rape, and to destroy as many as possible of the Israeli citizens, Israeli homes, Israeli cities. And now Israel is commemorating 1 year to this tragedy. And here behind me, the families of those victims are gathering here for the main event that will mark 1 year of this tragedy. And they will remember to the world and to the Israeli government also that still 101 Israeli women, men, elderly children in the captivity in the tunnels held by Hamas terrorists. They have almost no food, no water, even not the air to breathe in those tunnels. There is almost no air there and it's dark. And the ones that survived this captivity and came back, they told about the torture and about what they are going through there. So now the call from this event will be to the world, the international community, and also the Israeli Prime Minister and its government to do much more in order to bring those people back home, even if it means to do a ceasefire with Hamas and probably lead also to a ceasefire with Hezbollah and with Iran. Mm-hmm. But this is something that the Israeli people and Israeli government and Israel should pay in order for the next generation to sure. have this ethos of the Israeli society.
All right. Let me go across to Edward Joseph. Mr. Joseph, if there's any one thing that we may have learned in this war is that you, despite all the technology in the world, you can't right-size a conflict. You can't, particularly in areas which are densely packed, control the loss of lives, perhaps in the way that you want. But how would you respond to those who say that the loss of lives in Gaza and potentially in Beirut are disproportionate God. And that at the end of the day, it's civilians who are suffering the most?
First of all, good to be with you and the other guests and your viewers. And thank you for doing this program today. I think it's quite important. And let me, for your viewers, put it into context here in one that they can understand. Of course, India faces security threats from a neighbor, and particularly in Kashmir. And Indians, of course, know that the situation goes in cycles, that there are times of relative quiet and calm, and then all of a sudden that's disrupted. And we should be very mindful here that there was calm prior to October 7th. So there was a ceasefire in place. Everyone talks about the need for a ceasefire. In fact, there was a ceasefire, a long-standing ceasefire that was in place in Gaza that was disrupted unilaterally by Hamas with its pre-planned attack into Israel, a pre-planned attack that was designed precisely to create the conditions that we've seen unfold. So that was on October 7th, again, broken by Hamas. On October 8th, that same sense of relative quiet was broken by Hezbollah in the north with his shelling into the northern part of Israel, which has continued to this day. So we have to be mindful of that. And then I think folks in India can relate and understand about that. Now, in terms of your question, of course, the civilian suffering in Gaza is terrible. There's no doubt about it. And any normal thinking person should acknowledge and have empathy for Gazan civilians who are indeed suffering. We have to, of course, to weigh the question of proportionality, we have to remember, again, just as in a fight in Kashmir would involve at least two parties, we cannot only focus on what India's responsibility would be in the event of an attack, massacres coming in to India, perpetrated in India from across the line of control, say. We could not only focus on India's responsibility, we'd have to look at what terrorists inside Kashmir are doing. And that would only be normal and fair, and we would have to do the same to make a proper judgment about proportionality. We would have to do the same on Gaza. Yes, does Israel have its responsibility? Of course Israel has its responsibility. And so does Hamas. And unfortunately, that latter fact has been completely obscured in the conversation. So not only have the attacks of October 7th premeditated, brutal, not designed for national liberation, but designed for the destruction of a nation that is Israel and the homeland for Jews. That's been forgotten, not just October 7th, but everything that Hamas has done since October 7th has also been largely overlooked, including its deliberate decision to embed its fighters and its materiel in civilian locations.
All right, just give me a second. I just want to bring in Ambassador Sajjanar. I get your point,
Mr. Joseph, and I'll come
back to you.
When we look at this question, which is important, of judging proportionality, we have to consider the actions of both sides. Now, Israel is still responsible to act according to international law. That's correct. But places lose their protection under the Geneva Conventions, lose their protection when they're used for military purposes. So we have to bear that in mind. The other aspect here, of course, overlooked, understandably, because they're invisible to the public, is the infrastructure, the
tunnels.
All right,
Mr. Joseph, just be with me for a second.
Israel,
I'm not sure you can hear me. I'll come back to you in a moment.
350 miles
of tunnels. To the strike rotating, as it were. Let me go across to Ambassador Sajjanar. I think the one part which is perhaps most frightening at this stage are impending strikes on Iran by Israel. Israel says they'll do it at a time and place of their choosing, but that they will do it. Again, the possibility of 1 year down the road, this war is escalated. It's all over the place now. And this might be perhaps the most dangerous part, a direct attack by Israel on Iran. And of course, Iran has done that to Israel as well.
Yeah, you're very right, Vishnu. Thank you very much for having me on your show. You are very right. I think what everyone has really been apprehensive about is whether this war is going to escalate. But, you know, so far the escalation, of course, has taken place. But I think we need to be mindful that the escalation has basically taken place as far as the proxies of Iran are concerned. You know, first several months were spent in terms of dealing what Israel did as far as Hamas is concerned. You are very right. You know, all the civilians, men, women, children that have died, that is a matter of great sadness and regret. But that is what has happened as far as Hamas is concerned. After that, it is another proxy, that is Hezbollah. After that, there is, you know, as far as the Houthis are concerned, there have been attacks coming from there. I think Israel's position has been, it is responding to what Hamas did. It is on 7th October, it is responding to what Hezbollah started on the 8th of October, and it is also responding to what the Houthis have been doing. It is responding to what the Shia militias from Iraq and Syria have been doing. I think the fortunate part of this is that notwithstanding the fact that there have been 40,000 plus casualties that have taken place, and there have been huge protests and demonstrations on the streets of the Arab countries, neighboring countries, Egypt, Jordan, UAE, Saudi, you name it, all of them. But none of those governments have really acted in terms of rising up against or taking any action against Israel. I think that was the hope and that was the expectation of Iran, that once all these things takes place, the whole matter is going to blow over. And these countries, these governments will also be forced to come and, stand up in favor of the Palestinian people,
yes,
and in favor of the Hezbollah and Hamas, whom they see as acting for the Palestinian people. That has not happened.
No, it's not.
It's
happened
only Iran that has been there. And that also, after Iran attacked in April of this year with 300 odd projectiles and missiles, that Israel gave a pro forma response. And now they have come up with 200 ballistic missiles without giving any notice to either Israel or to any other country. So I think the ball is very much in Israel's court, but Iran has its back to the wall. Iran is placed itself in a very vulnerable position. So I think we'll really have to wait and see as to how things develop. Iran sees it doesn't have any support from any country, either in the region or outside, while Israel has all the support, not only from the United States, but France, UK, and so many other countries.
Okay. Adam Bellos, let me come back to you before I go across to Zaki Zaidi. Is it at all possible to consider a proportionate response from Israel to Iran, considering the fact that the Iranian ballistic missile attacks didn't target civilian populations? They attacked a military base. The success of those operations were very, very limited.
That's incorrect.
They didn't. There were no civilians on the ground other than one Palestinian who was.
Wait a minute.
Who lost
hold
their
on.
Life.
The entire country was targeted. Red alert sirens were surrounding the entire country from Beersheba to Tzfat.
You don't believe, Adam, that the attack was specifically targeting military bases which were struck?
No.
Nothing else
not.
Was struck?
I think that anybody that would think that only military bases were targeted would be very naive when it comes to the declared declarations of the Islamic Republic.
But
in addition
nothing
to that,
else was struck, Adam. There were some oil fields, one facility which
nothing,
was struck,
nothing else,
and there was a Nevatim air base which
excuse
was struck.
Excuse me. Nothing else was struck because of the Iron Dome and the Aaron Slit and the arrow sling. Okay, so David Sling. I think it's a very naive to say that civilian areas were not targeted, given that the entire country was inside of bomb shelters for hours. So I do have to correct you on that. That is completely incorrect. And my response to your question would be, is what is a proportional response to one of the largest ballistic missile attacks ever in the history of using ballistic missiles in warfare? I've noticed some of the language that you're using during this program, and you're constantly using a specific type of language that is laying a specific blame, I would think, to Israel when it comes to civilian deaths. You're using language of proportionality. And I'm just wondering, 1 year after October 7th, after everything that we know about what happened to the 1,200 victims of October 7th, the fact that 100 people are still being held hostage, given the conditions that we know that have been made public by the hostages themselves, who were either released or rescued. I don't really understand this language of proportionality. Okay,
no, it's
Israel
a question which I asked
proven.
You, and Adam, I stand by that question. And that question, and let me rephrase that question, perhaps you'd like to answer it differently. International observers have said that Iran right-sized their attack, and hence they were able to strike only a very few military facilities unsuccessfully. You can disagree with that point. But my question to you is, would Israel's response to Iran be proportionate, or would there be attacks which would be against potentially civilian areas as well? I ask this
again,
because Iran doesn't have the ability to defend itself in quite the same way that Israel does, and therefore the loss of civilian life, innocent people,
maybe Iran would be able to defend itself better if they weren't pumping billions or millions of dollars into their proxies. But let me just say that the Israeli people have no qualms with the Persian Iranian people.
Right.
We actually feel a close kinship to them. So the idea of attacking any civilian areas would be against the ethos of the Israeli army, let alone whenever the Israeli army perpetuates any form of ground force use or air force use in any area where there are civilians. They do whatever they can to warn civilians to leave the area, like we most recently saw in Lebanon prior to the pager attack. As well, the pager attack, the cell phone attack, the walkie-talkie attack was a clear indication of how long and how methodical the Israeli government and Secret Service and army is when it comes to targeting non-civilians. And let me just add, the smartest thing that the Israeli government can do, if it's possible, I'm not sitting in the security cabinet right now, would be to attack the Iranian nuclear sites that we know exist and to take out as many military targets as possible. I'm sorry, but I do have to disagree, considering that most international forces have never really sided with Israel on anything, or any international observers. The very first UN peacekeeping troop was removed prior to the 1967 war with the request of Nasser. Okay, it's been over 1 year, and the International Red Cross has not visited any of the hostages, but were able to get to the ladies, the women of Boko Haram, quite quickly. This is one of the first conflicts in the history of the existence of the International Red Cross, where the International Red Cross has not even been able to get access to these hostages.
Right.
So I really have to say, I do not believe many Israelis or any members of the military or any members of the government care what the international observation community has to say about this conflict, given the way that they have constantly sided with Iran, and given what we know about how Iran
I accept that point. It's clear from Israel's actions that Israel, and they've stated this on record, they don't really care what anybody thinks. This is a war which Israel feels is just and needs to be fought in a particular way. But let me go across to Zaki Zaidi. Zaki, you can see the divisions in this conversation and on this debate. I mean, it reflects what the situation is on the ground. What is the way forward?
Hi, Vishnu. Thank you for having me on your show. First of all, I would like to add what the guest from Israel was saying, that Iran specifically targeted the civilian sites and it targeted indiscriminately. But I guess the international observers and the couple of Israeli media institutions like Haaretz and Times of Israel, they themselves verified that Iran calibrated in such a way that the target was only the military sites, the air bases, and not to blow the conflict out of proportion. And to extend to, I would like to add that Hezbollah also till now, they have probably targeted only the military bases and that, not indiscriminate attacks. On that,
wait a minute. The Majl Shams attack.
The way Adam was saying.
Adam, I'll come back to you. Let him make his point. Let him make his point. Yeah.
Hind Rajab, who was sprayed with more than 200 bullets in Gaza, she was a 5-year-old kid, and she was also sort of Hamas, and he was also agree that there are no civilian casualties. Ask him, he would say no civilian casualties. So you cannot put your head in the sand. What's happening? There's a massive toll of civilian life that have been gone in the aerial bombardment in this conflict. And I was just reading that the destruction of Gaza is to such an extent that at least it will take 15 years to clear the rubble of Gaza, and forget about the reconstruction, forget about the people, forget about the people who have more than 40,000 people who have been killed. But right now, if you see from the Israeli perspective, Netanyahu is in no mood of bringing back the hostages back. The conversation, the dialogue about a possible hostage deal and a possible ceasefire is not on the table. And many civilian lives have to be sacrificed till the new president is elected in the U.S. And that's it is understandable that until unless a new U.S. president is elected, ceasefire is not on the table.
All right, Adam, quickly respond, then I'll go back to Edward Joseph.
I just have to say one thing. I do think it's completely incorrect and irresponsible to be saying that Hezbollah has not been targeting civilian areas. I was in Majal Shams. Okay, I held the mothers of the children who were lost. Okay, weeks ago, I saw the damage and where the rocket was fired from and where it landed, and it was a direct shot onto a playground where 12 innocent Druze children were taken from this world. And it was the attack actually happened at the exit of the soccer field that was right in front of the bomb shelter that they were running to, that they had less than 3 seconds to get to because of where the attack came from and how close it was to them. And it was in the direction that all the children were running to get into safety. I'm sorry, but we are dealing with enemies of Israel that worship death, that do not care about civilian life. There's a new report that was just released in Israel from an operative in Hamas that 80% of the 42,000 are Hamas operatives or their family members. So to start laying any type of blame of civilian casualties on the state of Israel, given the fact that this was a war that we did not start and that we did not want, and that was perpetuated in the most barbaric medieval acts that we've seen since the Holocaust, if not prior, it's inappropriate.
You know, Zaki, quick response before I move to my other panelists. Yeah, Zaki, go ahead.
Just like you won't accept that, like in Gaza or Lebanon, there are civilian casualties. The problem lies there.
Of course, there are civilian casualties. I'm not denying that there are civilian casualties.
Was it Hamas or a five-year-old kid who died of the pager attack was Hezbollah? Like I
understand that, but that's called collateral damage. And if you look at the ratio of combatant to civilian, if you look at the ratio of combatant to civilian casualties, this is the lowest in modern warfare that we've ever seen.
300 people just like their
civilians. Wait, hold on.
Adam, hold on. Let him make his point. Adam,
danger.
Let him make his point. Let's not fight.
Excuse me.
But Adam, hold on. Let me try and balance this out. I'm not shutting down anybody. Let him make his point. Zaki, go ahead. Yes.
Yeah. So my point is like Israel till now. What is the end game? It has been a year, like since fighting in Gaza, and Israel is fighting war at seven fronts, and now there is very high possibility that it would go on a full fledged war with Iran, and probably I'm saying this because Netanyahu might get his dream true, like he has been dreaming of attacking the nuclear sites and to find a pretext, but in the coming days we will see that how things turn out.
Interrupting because I need to start wrapping this up. Before I go back to Edward Joseph, I just wanted to play out this interview which I did earlier today with Dr. Khaled Al-Shawa, a 31-year-old surgeon from Gaza City. He was able to get to an area where the line was acceptable. We could hear him properly. This is what he told us.
After 1 year, it's just getting worse every day. It's not getting better anymore at all. The situation is just getting worse regarding healthcare providing, regarding people, regarding hospitals and healthcare system infrastructure. The healthcare system is totally collapsed. Every few weeks, we start to renovate some hospitals, some medical centers, some primary healthcare centers, but again, it gets targeted by bombs, by bombardment, and again we start from under zero, from the beginning again.
Doctor, are you able to get basic medical supplies into Gaza right now for just basic surgeries to happen, medical surgeries? How is that happening?
Some supplies, we are successfully getting some supplies, but this is very scarce. This is very little, very small amount. Moreover, it's not regularly entering Gaza. Every few months, we get a few conveys or few missions to deliver some medications, some disposables, some supplies. Again, it's not enough at all for regular or even basic surgical equipment, basic surgical operations, basic even for primary health care, for some basic medications for diabetes, for hypertension, for example. The supplies are not enough at all.
Doctor, in terms of reconstruction of homes, it's possibly too early at this stage, but what are families doing whose homes have been destroyed? They've all moved to the south of Gaza a fair long time back now. They have no way of knowing when they can return, and even if they do, it's not as if their homes are still standing.
Most of the people who went to the south are not getting to the north again. Even the people in the north, they lost their homes. They are staying in tents in the streets and hospitals and public places, for example, for governmental places or schools, shelters. They are seeking any room, any place, any roof to stay under. As you know, we have been through summer, winter, and summer. Again, we are getting into the next winter, and nothing is getting better at all. People are not finding basic needs, basic shelters, basic food, sanitation, clean water. This is not available, nor in the north, nor in the south.
All right, Dr. Al-Shawat, take care, be safe with you and your family. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts.